San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money, Not Theirs. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future. Now, It's Your Money, Not Theirs on Talk Radio 760 KFMB.
Right, good evening. Welcome to It's Your Money, Not Theirs. I'm Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, producer, coming at you with 50,000 watts of power. We're being heard not just in San Diego County, but Los Angeles County, Orange County, Riverside, up to Seattle on a good night. And every week here's a good night. But anyway, we've got a really great show for you tonight. And now it's time for me to introduce my co-host, the illustrious gentleman who is a marathon runner. He's a family office advisor. He's a core member of STAR, Strategic Trusted Advisors Roundtable of San Diego. The one, the only, Richard Muzio, CPA. Good evening, Richard.
Good evening, Joe. Have you recovered from last week?
You know, I'm still pretty ecstatic, but yes, I finally was able to get some sleep.
I love your line. To most people, it was a small plaque, but to me, it was like climbing Mount Everest. That's a good line.
Did I say that?
You said that in an email.
I hope I said it at the event.
The event was, yeah.
But, you know, a lot of people, we should tell them. I mean, if you go up to the Whaling Bar at the La Valencia, I think this outside of the Geisel Library and outside of Dr. Seuss's hometown in Springfield, Massachusetts, and maybe one other place, this is probably the only place in San Diego that acknowledges that Dr. Seuss wrote all those books from 1948 to 1991, and you can sit at his booth and get some of that creative genius aura next time you're up at the La Valencia Hotel, which is a beautiful place. By the way, Richard, you stayed there with family. How was it?
Yeah, it was great. My daughter's birthdays, my daughters, Mia and Demi, respectively turned 20 and 16 on July 10th. They have the same birthday, so we spent a couple nights at La Valencia, and it was super great service, great service ethic by the staff, great place, great view.
Wait a minute, both your daughters have the same birthday.
They have the same birthday, July 10th, same birthday as your mother.
My mother, correct.
And yeah.
She turned, she was a little more than 16, but it...
Yeah.
But anyway, and then...
Don't give away her age on the radio, Joe.
I'm not going to do that, even though she's not within earshot of our station, but that's okay.
Somebody will tell her if you say that out loud, so
that's
don't.
That's right. But... hey, then after 7 o'clock last Sunday night, what a great show. Another icon in the sports broadcasting world, superstar of sports broadcasting, Dick Enberg. And that was quite a treat. And you loved that, didn't you, Richard? I mean, you guys were...
Well, it's always fun, yeah. I mean, when I can talk to somebody about, you know, basketball games in the Houston Astrodome in 1968, that's pretty cool for me.
Yeah. And I just want to remind listeners, if they want to see photographs from Audrey Geisel's visit with all her many friends last week, that if they go to your website, my website, our website, I guess, IY Money, which is pretty easy, iymoney.com, there's photographs there. And you can also get all the podcasts from all the shows, including Dick Enberg. But let's not delay any further. We've got another superstar from the world of law and politics and regulation and all that good stuff. How about I go ahead and introduce him, Richard? Is that okay with you?
How about you do that?
Well, this gentleman's been on 60 Minutes several times. He's been in Inside Job, the film the documentary that won the Oscar for Best Documentary. He's been, PBS ran a 4-hour special on Wall Street called Wall Street Money Power. New York Times, he's the go-to guy, it seems now, for anything dealing with the ills of Wall Street. And I'd love to, and he's obviously a Yale Law School graduate and a professor at University of San Diego Law School. And I know you're a USD grad yourself, right, Richard?
Class of 1980.
That's correct. Anyway, without any further delay, the one, the only, Frank Partnoy. Frank, good evening.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure. Our pleasure. Now, we're going to talk about your latest book called Wait, The Art and Science of Delay, but...
Joe, you're supposed to go wait.
Well, wait.
The Art and Science of Delay. You're supposed to pause.
But, okay, I'll wait. But Frank, let's just get into your bio a little bit, like where you were raised and how you found your way into Wall Street and back to San Diego, et cetera. If we could start at maybe the high school or whatever year you want to start and take us forward.
Sure, we go way back. Well, I'm from Kansas, so mm-hmm. I was born and raised in the Midwest and went to public schools all through college, went to University of Kansas before going to law school and experiencing the Northeast, and sort of always had in the back of my mind this fascination with Wall Street and numbers. I was a math geek mm-hmm. as a kid, really enjoyed math. And so I went to law school. I clerked for a judge, and then I started out working on Wall Street on a derivatives trading desk.
You went to law school out of University of Kansas. You must have had some pretty good academic credentials, obviously, right? I mean,
Sure. I worked hard and was fortunate to get into a good law school and get a good clerkship. And then I kind of veered away from the law for a little while and took a two-year trip through Wall Street working at CS First Boston and Morgan Stanley. And back then, people had never heard of derivatives, these crazy financial instruments.
So what year did you get hit Wall Street in the early 80s?
This is the mid-90s.
Mid-90s.
So 1993 through 1995. This is when Orange County went bankrupt because of derivatives, and there were a number of high-profile blow-ups at municipalities. Mutual funds lost a lot of money. People might remember Mexico devaluing the peso in December of that year, and the government had to come in and bail out Mexico. And I was there for all that.
And, of course, prior to that, we had the junk bonds of the 80s and another real estate bubble, and we had another massive bailout in the RTC, Resolution Trust Corporation, which became the largest agency that the federal government created post-World War II or post-New Deal, I believe. So it's funny how things tend to repeat themselves. But so you weren't at Yale Law School when Bill and Hillary Clinton were there. Were you there?
No, I was not. I was after them.
Okay.
I don't have any good Bill and Hillary stories.
You're much too young, I guess, okay? Or much younger than they are, so. So you hit Wall Street in the mid-90s, and things were blowing up. So, and you were at Morgan Stanley, and then what happened next? I mean, when did you get out to USD Law and all that?
I spent 2 years practicing law in Washington, D.C., and my wife was there. She was working for the State Department in the Office of Legal Advisor. Mm-hmm. So we did a couple of years there, and then we came out to USD in 1997, and I've been teaching there since. I just finished my 15th year on the faculty, and I love it. It's a great law school, great university.
Very highly rated law school. It's one of the best in the nation, and beautiful campus to boot. So
nothing to complain about.
Yeah. Anyway, so then you started writing books, and what was your first book?
Well, my first book was called FIASCO, F-I-A-S-C-O. It's an acronym that stands for the Fixed Income Annual Sporting Clays Outing, which was a shoot 'em up skeet shooting tournament that Morgan Stanley's derivatives group sponsored every year. It was sort of a drunken outing for clients and for people at the firms. Very locker room mentality that people hear about was definitely in evidence then. Mm-hmm. And so after I left the firm...
So the Dick Cheney shooting in the face, that didn't surprise you?
Not at all. These people are not particularly accurate, and I wasn't either, notwithstanding growing up in Kansas. I'm very dangerous when skeet are flying around.
Okay, so that was more or less a biography.
That was a book about my experiences there, mm-hmm. and so that was the first one, and that was published basically right when I started teaching at USD. So I wrote it during the period while I was practicing law after I was at Morgan Stanley. Mm-hmm. They weren't very happy about it. They issued a press release saying it was filled with inaccuracies and sensationalism. Mm-hmm. And if they hadn't done that, it probably wouldn't have sold any copies. But yeah. I was grateful to the
negative publicity is better than no publicity at all. So.
So that was the first one, and then I landed at USD, and I've been doing a lot of academic work on financial markets and financial market regulation. I wrote another book called Infectious Greed, which was published in 2003, and it warned about dangers in derivatives and credit default swaps and CDOs, all this kind of crazy stuff that blew up in 2007 and 2008. So that book maybe was a little bit too early to the scene, but talked about those kinds of problems. And then I wrote a book called The Match King, which was published about 3 years ago about the 1920s and sort of the original Bernie Madoff, this guy, Ivar Kruger, who became known as the Match King because he got monopolies on match production throughout Europe and came to the U.S., in the 1920s, as the markets were boiling over with enthusiasm, sort of like they were before the recent crisis. Mm-hmm. And he told American investors, "Have I got a deal for you?" And they snapped it up, and he turned out to be a massive, massive pyramid scheme. Huh. And so I spent 6 years doing research, research for that book, which was very interesting. I mean, one of the most amazing things I found in that six-year period was that, as you say, history repeats itself, and the kinds of financial shenanigans that he was up to in the 1920s, the kinds of complicated financial instruments, they were all there then. I mean, we didn't have computers. We didn't have fancy algorithms.
We didn't have the SEC either, right? We had nothing.
No, nothing. No, yeah, you had the New York Stock Exchange, basically, as the gatekeeper. And we got the SEC because of this guy, because of Ivar Krueger and his collapse and the crash of 29. I was just fascinated by his story. He was discovered in a Paris flat with a bullet in the center of his heart on March 12th, 1932, and people investigated whether he had committed suicide or been murdered by one of Jack Morgan's henchmen who were following him because they were insanely jealous of all the business he had taken from the Morgan family. And some people thought that he had faked his own suicide and escaped into the night. That's sort of the Hollywood ending. Mm-hmm. So it was a really interesting story, and then I finished that and then sat back, and then this financial crisis hit.
Yeah. So, but you saw this derivative crisis brewing as early as when, 2000, 2001? I mean, I know the internet bubble was deflating, and a lot of those companies were getting sued and going out of business left and right. How long were you tracking derivatives? Was it back when you first hit Wall Street, you knew a lot about that?
No, when I first hit Wall Street, I didn't know anything about derivatives. But I was trained, and so I learned a lot. It was a great learning experience for 2 years. But I've been writing about derivatives since 97. The first, when I came to try to get a job at USD, and I talked to the law faculty and presented my first academic paper, it was about derivatives. My first book was about derivatives, published in 1997, and that's been an area of interest for me continuously since then for 15 years.
And the courses you teach are entitled what?
Well, I teach a basic corporate law course. I'm co-author of a corporate law casebook, so just the basic business law course for second and third year law students. I teach, over the years, I've taught a bunch of different courses, white-collar crime, emerging financial markets. The white collar crime course, by the way, is not a how-to course.
Do the students cheat in that course?
And then I teach a corporate finance course, and I teach a course called Deals, which is a transactional course. Increasingly, USD students are really good. They're smart, and they increasingly are going into transactional practice. So I teach a course in that area.
And, of course, you head up the Center for Securities and Corporate Law, right? Or is it Corporate and Securities
Law? Yeah, Corporate and Securities, that's right. And we've been bringing in a number of speakers. Mm-hmm. We try to, all this is, most of them are free for the community. We try to bring high-profile people, SEC commissioners, recent authors, regulators, lawyers, bankers.
Are those open to the public if they go on the website, or is it mostly just for campus?
No, look on the website. We ask that people register generally, but our philosophy has been to try to make them free whenever possible. We've had very generous sponsors so far. So far, we've been able to have them be available.
Yeah. So we'll get to, gotta take a break. Hey, we'll be right back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs with Professor Frank Partner, Richard Musio, and myself. Stay tuned. All right, we're back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs with Richard Musio, myself, and our terrific guest, Professor Frank Partnoy. So welcome back, everybody.
So Frank, question. What thought popped into your mind to cause you to write a book that's called Wait? And how long did it take you to write the book? How long did you wait before you wrote this thing?
I waited a long time. It's in some ways, it's been taking my whole life because I'm a procrastinator, and so this book is a very spirited defense of procrastination.
Interesting. See, I don't believe in procrastination.
Tell me why.
Well, I have too much to do every day, then there's enough hours in the day to do it, so I don't think I procrastinate personally because I'm always trying to focus on one thing when there's, 20 things to do.
Well, yeah.
And I don't blame myself for the fact that there's 20 things to do.
Your approach is exactly the way people should think about procrastination. So there's the scholars who study procrastination say there are an infinite number of things that you could be doing at any time. So our natural state as human beings is to be procrastinating. So why should you feel bad if you're putting something off, if you're doing something now that's a high priority, that's socially useful? If somebody has a closet they haven't cleaned up in 5 weeks, but they're working on a cure for cancer, or they're helping your listeners save their money, why should we get on them for not cleaning up their closet?
Of course, it depends what decision. I mean, if you're down at an eighth of a tank of gasoline, obviously you can't procrastinate for a week. I mean, at some point you're going to have to pull in the gas station.
Yeah, absolutely right. And so the wisdom is, I sort of got at this as a kid from thinking about making my bed and waiting until the last possible moment. You know, my mom would say, we've got company coming over at 6 o'clock. You need to make your bed. And I'd say, no, I want to wait as long as possible. It'll take me a minute. I'll do it at 5.
Yeah, because what if company doesn't show up?
Exactly. What if they change their mind on the way over? I want hard evidence. I want to see a car in the driveway. I want to knock at the door. I want to know. Otherwise, I'll have wasted my time.
Mark Twain said, never put off until tomorrow what you can put off until the day after tomorrow.
That's right. Such a great quote. I love that quote. Yeah. I've lived by it in a way. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in this kind of two-step process of first figuring out what time world you're living in. So what's the maximum amount of time? If you've got an eighth of a tank of gas left, what's the maximum amount of time you can go? You don't want to wait too long, right? Because then you've created a problem for yourself. And then the second step is to delay as long as you can within that time. And that two-step process actually shows up over and over again, that top CEOs and government leaders use it, professional athletes use it, people should use it when they're apologizing, all kinds of business decisions should involve this, what I call the management of delay. Mm-hmm. And that we shouldn't feel bad about it. This kind of anti-procrastination industry grew up in the 1970s with Peter Drucker and David Allen telling us, you know, get everything done right now, first things
first. But didn't it start sooner, like the Puritan work ethic?
Yeah, that's right, actually. If you go back and look at the 18th century, Jonathan Edwards...
Devil's something or other.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Jonathan Edwards gave this this anti-procrastination lecture that really took off. We've been feeling guilty about procrastinating as Americans for centuries, but it really took off. The big movement, I think, that picked up on that Puritan ethic started in the 1970s, and it's run into the crush of technology. I mean, the big problem now is that we all are speeded up in our decision-making dramatically by 24-hour news media and email and social media, and we've had this kind of battle against procrastination run into the teeth of technology in the last few years, and that kind of motivated me to study this.
Trading markets are 24 hours now here and around the world, right? But you were mentioning something about the Lehman Brothers.
Yeah, so the one reason I wanted to write this book, Wait, was to study procrastination. But the other was in looking at the financial crisis, 2007, 2008. I was studying it as an academic, and I was interviewing a bunch of senior Wall Street people, and I interviewed some senior executives from Lehman Brothers. And I discovered that they had organized a decision-making course. This is in the fall of 2005. They had taken a bunch of their executives, 4 dozen top officials, to the Palace Hotel on Madison Avenue and hold them up with a bunch of Harvard psychologists and decision-making experts. They had designed custom-made implicit association tests to try to tell them what their own biases were. And they had invited Malcolm Gladwell, who had just published Blink, the best-selling book, to come in and give a capstone lecture. And Joe Gregory, the president of Lehman Brothers, loved Blink and passed it out on the trading floor. And the ethic there was, go with your gut. Make snap decisions, because snap decisions are better. And they quickly marched back to their headquarters after they took this course. They marched across Manhattan to Times Square and proceeded to make the worst snap decisions in the history of financial markets. And I just thought that was fascinating, that they had tried to study decision-making and had come to this conclusion that snap decision-making was so much better. And so I started down the trail of basically trying to reconstruct a decision-making course for Wall Street and for all of us to explain how we could be better off delaying instead of always going with our gut.
And aren't they using poker now as a training tool of some sort at some houses?
Yeah, a lot of high-frequency trading shops and on Wall Street, poker is used as a kind of course. In fact, I interviewed one guy who has taught an entire course at MIT based on one poker hand. He has a bunch of PowerPoint slides, and he just shows this hand, and they talk about strategy for each turn of the card. These people are brilliant. I mean, they're some of the best decision makers in the world at these hedge funds, and they're all really good poker players. You do not want to sit down at a table with these folks.
So I would argue, since I play tennis and I still play real baseball, real hardball at the age of 54, I would argue, I'm not going to say that procrastination is bad, but if you argue that procrastination is bad, I would argue that impatience is even worse.
Yeah,
because I know when I'm standing on the mound with a baseball pitching, I don't have to throw it. I can wait and wait and wait all day. I mean, the guy at first base doesn't like that.
That's absolutely right. And one of the, I think, kind of magic aspects of baseball is timing, right? That it's this game where there is so much variability in terms of how long people wait. There's less variability for hitters. I mean, hitters, you don't know what pitch you're going to get, but you know that you probably have something less than 500 milliseconds to hit the ball.
Mm-hmm.
And the best hitters, high-speed studies of professional athletes suggest, are able to wait until the last possible minute. They perfect their stroke. They get so
fast. Or the last possible millisecond.
Last possible millisecond, absolutely. The study suggests that about 50 milliseconds is the difference between professionals and amateurs. And think about that. I mean, we can't think about it, actually. Benjamin Libet, a neuroscientist, showed that 500 milliseconds is the consciousness barrier. So we cannot think about 50 milliseconds. But a professional athlete who can wait an extra 50 milliseconds picks up a lot of extra information about the speed, flight, trajectory of the ball. It's ball ID, right? Ball identification. Mm-hmm. And you watch the greatest hitters, and they're able to do this, right? Ted Williams could do it, the great hitters today, Albert Pujols when he's playing well. He can wait until the last possible millisecond.
Yeah, the baseball term is they stay back.
Exactly right.
I think, Tony, aren't there some computer games now that actually can train your eye to, work faster and picking up a baseball being pitched to you?
The only way to practice hitting a moving baseball, Joe, is to practice hitting a moving baseball, trust me.
But I think there's probably eye exercise.
And there's a lot, actually, Rich, there's a lot of science behind what you've just said, that visual reaction time for all of us is about the same. That we take about 200 milliseconds to react to a pitch we just watched Wimbledon, these tennis serves coming in at 100 plus miles an hour, that if you're just sitting on the sofa and you're just pushing a button, that it takes about 200 milliseconds. I hear that music.
We've got to take a few milliseconds right now.
Wait,
here comes the break, folks. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs after these announcements. Hang on.
Now, it's Your Money, Not Theirs on Talk Radio 760 KFMB.
We're back with more of It's Your Money, Not Theirs. And over to Richard to thank some sponsors.
We want to thank our major sponsor, UBS. They were well represented at the Dr. Seuss event last Sunday. Mike Coranta and Michael Kaniger came down all the way from Los Angeles. And also Rich Gaines with Family Legacy Legal, Sean Puckett and Steve Sefton, who also attended the event last Sunday with Regions Bank, the best business bank in San Diego. Our favorite CPAs, Don Epic and Paul Polito with Polito Epic CPAs. Carl Sheeler with Business Valuations Limited. Carl, I hope you're enjoying your vacation in lovely New Mexico. And Jason Kruger with Signature Analytics. Thank you, everybody.
And it was a great dinner at the La Valencia Hotel in the Mediterranean Room prior to interviewing Dick Emberg last week. So it was just a super day all the way around. But folks, if you want to get any more information about Frank Partnoy and his books, you go to frankpartnoy.com. And he's been traveling all over the country and actually across the pond. He's been in London. He's addressed the Royal Society for the Arts. He's been in Boston, New York, Washington, D.C., Seattle. This coming Wednesday at noon, you can go to either one of these. At noon, he'll speak to the Strategic Trusted Advisors Roundtable at the Sheraton La Jolla. And that evening, I believe it's 7:30, Warwick's in La Jolla. Landmark bookstore here in San Diego area. Every major notable person who's written a book has been there. So that's usually free, but get there early because it's limited seating. And I'm sure Professor Partnoy will be glad to sign some books. So, gents, back to baseball a little bit.
Yeah, back to baseball. So, Frank, you were saying that everybody can sort of recognize something in the same amount of time. The question is, what do they do about it?
That's right. So imagine that you're about to hit a major league fastball and you have 500 milliseconds. It takes you 200 milliseconds to visually react. Okay, that's if you were sitting on the sofa and you just had to push a button, you didn't have to pick up a heavy bat and swing it, right? So you've got 500 minus 200, you've got 300 milliseconds left over. And what professional athletes, the best baseball players, are able to do is compress their stroke to get so fast at swinging the bat, at actually hitting the ball, so that they free up, say, 200 milliseconds to process information about the ball coming in, to do this act of ball identification. That, for me, it would take me 300 milliseconds. I'd be too late. You know, I'd wait 600 milliseconds, and the ball would have already gone by.
I challenge anybody out there, if next time you go to a Padres game, try to at least get behind home plate, maybe for the warm-up. See how fast that ball is coming in over the plate. And it's unbelievable to me how anybody can hit that thing, period.
Where my seats are, Joe, you can hear a 95-mile-an-hour fastball hiss. I love it. The best I can hit at the batting cages is about 82 or 83.
Wow, yeah, that's awfully fast, 82, 83. You just don't have enough time. It's not a conscious act either, so you have to be so practiced and trained.
And at the batting cage, you don't have to worry about the break of the ball.
Yeah. Or it hitting you.
Well, that's not necessarily true.
Well, speaking of perception, I know Frank in the book Weight, The Art and Science of Delay, he gets into subliminal advertising and subliminal messaging, and he mentions the movie Fight Club, and you'll have to get into the book to realize why he gets into that. But I picked up a copy of Completely Video. I want to give them a shameless plug because it's a great little video store. You can get things there for $1.50, and these days, every buck is important. And they're in Adams Avenue right next to Lestat. So go see James over there and pick up yourself up a nice movie. But the other thing is, our engineer is Justin Hart. His replacement coming up for the next couple of weeks is Chad Benson. And Frank and Richard, you'll be intrigued to know that his business partner, Chad's partner, is Jim Ewells, and he wrote the movie Fight Club. So I think we're going to stick around tonight and have a little chat with him. How about that?
Let's get Jim Ewells on the show.
Yeah, we could probably do that. Yeah. So anyway.
So, Frank, one more question about sports, then we can get back to Wall Street. So, similar concept in tennis?
Yes, absolutely. There have been a number of high-speed studies of tennis players. And, again, Jimmy Connors, why was he so good at returning serves? He was able to delay as long as possible. You know, we're taught as kids, we hear that these players are so good because they're fast, but they're actually so good because they're slow.
Well, in tennis, it's fast feet, slow hands.
Yes, and fast eyes.
And fast eyes. Right. But it doesn't matter how good your hands are. If you can't get to where you have to be in tennis, you've got no chance whatsoever.
Yes, that's right. It's a combination of physical...
compared to baseball, where the hitter's stationary.
Yes, that's a big difference between tennis and baseball. But in both sports, you're talking about a physical reaction that needs to happen as quickly as possible so that you free up your brain, basically, to process information. And this is a kind of model for us to use in our everyday decisions. The professional athletes are doing it very quickly at pre-conscious speeds, but the two-step process of first figuring out what's the maximum amount of time that you can wait, and then waiting until the last possible minute is a pretty good lesson for us in our daily lives.
Interesting.
Yeah, I saw Pete Sampras serve, I believe in the mid-90s, against Thomas Muster in a match out here at Indian Wells, and the first two serves, I sit on the baseline, I was lucky and got some seats, but 136 or 37 miles an hour, the first two serves, and he two aces, and I just turned to the people next to me. We just laughed because, to me, I don't even know how anyone could get any part of a racket on that thing. But
that's from 78 feet away, so it's very similar to a 100-mile-an-hour fastball in baseball.
Yeah,
exactly right. And it's kind of interesting that these sports have evolved to be right at the cusp of conscious reaction time.
Right.
So it's 500 milliseconds for both. And baseball would be a lot less interesting to watch if the pitching mound were 30 feet or if it were in center field. But we kind of got the distance right.
You're on 30 feet, nobody would get a hit.
It would just be based on, you'd have to swing immediately.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, it'd be pure randomness.
So how was this translated?
From 100 feet, it looked like one of our over 38 games.
So let's bring this full circle or over to Wall Street and why weight is an important read with respect to Wall Street and derivatives and trading and everything else. You said that 70% of the trading now is high-frequency trading.
That's right, high-frequency trading by computers and computer algorithms. Wall Street moves at a very, very quick pace now, and unfortunately, investors also move at a too rapid pace, and it hurts investors and I think is hurting Wall Street in terms of its strategic decision-making. But the firms that are able to manage delay are able to outperform. The firms that are able to understand, even at the speed of light, that are understanding how much delay is appropriate, that even for high-frequency trading, that you don't necessarily want to be the first one within a couple of milliseconds, that sometimes if you delay, for example, I found one firm that delayed 65 milliseconds, that they found that was the right amount of delay.
I saw UNX.
UNX, which is, it's an amazing story because they co-located, which is the word for firms moving from far away to the New York Stock Exchange. They had set up computers in Burbank, California, but it was taking the signals from Burbank to New York 35 milliseconds, even at the speed of light, and so going through fiber optic wires. So they had decided, hey, let's move to the New York Stock Exchange, will cut our trading time in half, and they actually found they performed worse once they moved. And when they were able to slow down their computers, they actually slowed them down just back to 65 milliseconds, that they performed better.
So what do you tell the day trader these days? I mean, it's a big institutional game anymore. I mean, if you think you're going to stay home on your computer and beat the market, it's next to impossible, right, as a small investor?
It's very difficult to compete with these kinds of complex algorithms. And, for most investors, a more strategic perspective is a better approach. That there are lots of studies that show that day trading will rack up a lot of transactions costs for you, and will won't necessarily help you generate returns. There have been a number of studies of Jim Cramer, for example.
I was going to mention him.
People like watching, I mean, he's incredibly smart and tremendously entertaining, and the show is fun to watch. But what the studies suggest is that although his stocks go up the next day, on average more than 2%, an increase in market capitalization of about $77 million, that if you buy those stocks, you're going to buy them at a higher price, and they're going to end up performing worse over the longer period.
I wonder
of time.
How much of that is him driving the market for a particular stock. I mean, he must have some impact, don't you think?
People follow him, right? Yeah. I'm sure you guys, if the markets were open right now, you could drive the price of a stock right now.
Yeah, we could.
Recommendations.
So, Frank, I'm not an impatient guy, but I hate waiting. And so my question is as follows. What does the concept of time have to do with any of this that you're talking about? The hour or the minute? Or time, or billing by the hour, or perceiving value to be inherent in some rate that applies to an hour?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we've been talking about very short time periods, and what I do in the book in Wait is I start off with short time periods and then telescope out to progressively longer and longer time periods of seconds, minutes, hours. The hour is a great one. You mentioned hours, and 58% of people bill by the hour or are paid by the hour. And the hourly wage exerts an incredibly pernicious influence on all of us because it forces us to think about time as being money. So we think about, well, should I go to my kid's soccer game? That's going to cost me 2 hours. Multiply that by my hourly rate. It's a really bad way to think. And billing by the hour and making more money by the hour actually forces us to be more impatient. There was a study that Sanford DeVoe, a psychologist at the University of Toronto, did where he set up people doing the same task. One group was paid $9 per hour. They were told they were billing out at $9 per hour. The other group was told they were being billed out at $90 per hour. The group that was being billed out at the higher rate became much more impatient. They had a harder time enjoying aesthetic activities like music or paintings.
Watching Fight Club.
Watching Fight Club, watching any of the other movies that Joe likes, which we won't talk about. But this paradoxical idea of how as you make more money, you realize your time is more valuable, and so you become more and more impatient. And it's really tragic. Those of us who are able to be successful and make more money, bill more by the hour, or get paid more money, find that we're progressively more and more impatient. And so it isn't necessarily a great thing to be paid by the hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I know in the CPA profession, customers hate being charged by the hour, too. Because the question is, what on earth does it have to do with the value of the service that you've just rendered?
Yeah, exactly right. So a lot of accountants and lawyers are trying to move away from that, to move to fixed rate billing. But it's hard. It's a hard transition because people are used to being paid by the hour.
Right, but we have to wait right here for a sec. We'll come right back with more of It's Your Money Right, Not Theirs after these words. Hey, folks, before we waste too much more time here, I want to make sure, get out to Warwick's Wednesday night. You can meet Professor Partnoy. He's been on 60 Minutes many, many times, and New York Times and a lot of other special places. Frank, you're obviously an expert on regulation. If you were czar for a day, are there any major regulations you'd like to bring back or any adjustments that you think we could immediately impose on the system to try and help us out?
I think what we ought to do is go back to what we did in response to the last major financial crisis in 1929. And we thought about regulation for a period of years, and we implemented a two-pillar approach. One was to require disclosure of important information, and the second was to implement an anti-fraud regime so that people who lied would be held responsible. And that worked pretty well for decades and decades. And then for various reasons, regulators, Congress, the Supreme Court, that has been eroded. Both of those pillars have been eroded. So that right now, if you look at a company's financial statements, that first pillar of disclosure, it isn't there. You cannot tell what it is you're buying. And the second pillar of anti-fraud, it's getting harder and harder to sue people for fraud if you've been defrauded. And we could tell from the prosecutions, they're non-existent. There aren't senior Wall Street executives who have been prosecuted. No one's doing jail time right now. So I would go back to that simple two-step approach. I think we've gotten into a very complex rules-based society with all financial regulation, and we've layered on top of that with Dodd-Frank. And I think that was the wrong way to go. I think we should go back to history and the simple two-pillared approach that worked well for decades.
Well, my criticism of financial information is it is indeed that it is all historical, and of course my own profession and the promulgating associations discourage forward-looking financial statements because they can't be relied on. Yet we live in an era, in my opinion, of almost real-time financial information in terms of how fast transactions happen. And when companies melted down in 2008, around then, people went out of business so fast you couldn't believe it. The fact that their financial statements were 2 or 3 months old didn't matter. The question was what was happening that week or that day. And there needs to be a way for, I think, the accounting profession to try to create real-time accounting, not historical accounting.
And then we hear about off-balance sheet transactions. And is that legal? I mean, can companies do this?
Oh, sure, yeah, absolutely. And I think both of you have raised important issues that I think could be addressed in a simple regulatory reform, which would be to require companies to disclose worst-case scenario analysis, which would be going forward. What is the worst case scenario? If housing prices decline by 30%, we're back in 2007, financial institutions tell us what is the worst case? How much money will you lose if that happens? Right now, nobody discloses worst case scenarios. They don't tell you how bad it could get. We could simply tell companies to disclose worst case scenarios. I think it would take care of both of those problems. The off-balance sheet problem, Joe, that you mentioned, is a problem because we can't look at the financial statements and figure out what the consequences of off-balance sheet liabilities and contingencies are. So either we can try to bring those things onto the balance sheet, which would be very difficult. I think it'd be a good idea. Or we can get at it kind of indirectly by saying, okay, you've put all this stuff off balance sheet. How bad can it get? Mm-hmm. What's the worst case scenario for all this stuff? If interest rates go up by 2%, how much money will we lose?
And that would cover their liability a little bit too if they've disclosed that, right? I mean,
I'm surprised that boards haven't asked their managers to do this more, that they haven't wanted to see this kind of more robust disclosure. Mm-hmm. I think that we'll see it eventually in the future, but it might take a while.
Mm-hmm.
So, Frank, you're going to be presenting at Star on Wednesday, and there was a great quote in your book that said that when you do a presentation or speech, the secret is to be done speaking or presenting before the listener is done listening. Can you please explain that? You're going to be put to the test on
Wednesday. Yeah, I will be put to the test. So maybe I should only talk for a couple of minutes. Yeah. I don't know. I'll have to try to gauge my audience. But I do think, you know, studies show that we speak too long, that we are most persuasive when we use 4 to 5 pauses per minute.
That was good right there.
Like
I noticed
one.
That one, yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, it's true of the great speakers and comedians that telling a joke is partly about the content of the joke, but it's mostly about the punchline, about figuring out how long to delay. And yeah, you absolutely don't. You want to make sure that your audience is paying attention. And I'm acutely aware of that, having students who are young and technology focused. And if I can't motivate them and keep them interested, they will tune out very, very quickly.
Well, I would imagine in one of your classes, if you paused for about 10 seconds, the students would get up and walk out because they would assume class was over, right?
Well, no, they're looking at their Facebook. They have their laptop.
They'll shop for a little while, but after a minute, they'll get
after
up.
After a minute, they'll get up and go, okay.
Or they're buying something on Amazon.
It's very interesting to compete with that now. You know, a lot of law professors want to shut down laptops in the classroom and not allow students to surf the web. And I understand that, but I actually view it as a message to me that I have to up my game, that I have to compete with that, and I have to show students that they'll get something of value out of listening to me more than they will out of being on the web.
Mm-hmm. That's
because you know what? Once they start practicing in the private sector, the public sector, the web's going to be there. That temptation will be there. And one of the things that we need to do for our kids and for students is help them to delay gratification. Studies show that that's one of the most important factors in happiness and success is the ability to delay gratification.
Well, we have to...
And we can no longer delay the end of the show, Joe, because I hear the music in the background.
Wait, the end is coming. But just until Wednesday, you can see Frank Partnoy at Warwick's on Wednesday at evening or down at Star that night. Thank you, Professor Partnoy. Thank you, Richard Musio.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chad. Thank you, Justin. Thank you, Dave Sniff, our programming genius, and Craig Blanke, our con executive. Have a great week, everybody. We'll be back next week.
Tired of paying outrageous prices for Viagra? Well, we have great news. Now you can finally get Viagra at huge discounts. Healthy Man allows you to save up to $500 on Viagra. Why pay U.S. pharmacy prices of $15 per pill or more when you can get Viagra for less than $3 a pill? Call today and get 40 Viagra pills for only $99. This could cost as much as $600 at your local pharmacy. You can't afford not to call us if you want Viagra at the lowest prices. Never pay $15 a pill pharmacy prices again. Get Viagra for less than $3 a pill. Call 800-213-2538 today to save up to $500 and get 40 pills for just $99. Healthy Man is fast, easy, and affordable. Operators are waiting at 800-213-2538 to take your call now. Call 800-213-2538. That's 800-213-2538. Again, 800-213-2538.
We follow the story.